welcome to the UCB Theater Podcast for this week. I'm John Frusciante.
Oh, and I'm Will Hines.
And we have a very special interview for you this week with Kevin Mullaney, right,
That's
Will?
Nice. Yeah, Kevin Mullaney.
if you could see the setup that Will and I have to record this, you would understand why
We're speaking
laughing.
Too closely We're into one microphone.
Very close to
very
each other
Very
right
close.
Super close.
Awkward for us.
Yeah, but wonderful for you.
Yeah.
Sorry that we've been delinquent on these podcasts. Will and I have been doing the podcast circuit.
Yeah, it's we've been touring the country. Doing a lot of tent shows and revival arrival things to save people and heal them with our podcast.
That's right. So we're going to skip right through all the usual nonsense and go right to the interview with Kevin Mullaney.
So enjoy it.
Bye.
Okay, we're back this week in the UCB Theater Podcast. We have a special guest, Mr. Kevin Mullaney. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, how are you doing?
Thank you so much for joining us. John and I are excited to have you. John,
yeah,
how do we summarize who Kevin is to our audience?
It's a tough thing to do. Kevin is a lot of things. I'm really excited to be to have Kevin on the podcast this
Why
week.
Why don't we start, Kevin, by going over things you've done out here at the UCB Theater in New York in the past? Like, kind of like, let's just do a quick like UCB bio for you.
Sure. Sure. Well, I met the UCB in Chicago. Mm-hmm. They were at the Improv Olympic. At the same time I was, kind of like a generation ahead of me. So they left for New York in 96, I think.
Yep.
And then 1998, I came out and did a short workshop or a brief workshop with them. It was like 1 or 2 days.
Okay.
And that was the summer of 98. And then about a month or two after Del died in the spring of 1999, they gave me a call, or actually Amy sent me an email out of the blue, completely out of the blue. I hadn't really been talking to them about this at all. And they said, hey, why don't you come out and teach some workshops for us? And it's temporary. And if it doesn't work out, that's great. But if it does work out, we'd want you to stay. And can you be out here in like 4 weeks?
Wow.
So that's what I did. And I think at that point, the only other person that was teaching for them was Armando.
Right.
So it was the four UCB, Armando. And then I came out. Ali came out shortly thereafter.
Right.
And Pat came out at some point, and then they started hiring within. So
Pat McCartney?
Yeah.
Yeah. Right.
So, yeah, I was one of the first teachers they brought out.
Right. Yeah, they would teach all the classes, and then it was like Armando. I remember that. Armando would do the level ones. They would do the other ones. And then I think you and those guys you mentioned would do the other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. Then the Swarm started teaching everything also.
Right. The next batch of teachers was like Billy and Delaney and Secunda.
Right. And Sean.
And Sean.
Right.
Right.
Okay, but then after that, you ended up really like – I mean, you basically did every job that has ever existed here. You were artistic director for a while. You ran the school you were one of the – and then eventually the senior teacher here. You set up the improv message board on the side. You created Spank, the 3-on-3 tournament. You brought Cage Match from Chicago to New York. You did all those things.
That's right.
There was a long time where basically every like – kind of like recurring institution in this community was something that you had either touched or created. Plus you were directing the Swarm, which was like the premier group here when they moved from Harold Knight to their weekend show.
Yeah.
You had your hands all over this joint.
And a lot of the things that still exist as institutions, whether they be monthly or regular institutions to the theater or the improv community, are things that you had either originated or had a hand in originating.
I guess so.
That is true.
Yep.
That is why I mean, that's one of the reasons why we're excited to have you on here. So eventually when we – and one of the focuses we want to have in this conversation is to talk to you about teaching and things that are important to you as an improv teacher and philosophies and suggestions you think about.
Mm-hmm.
Like basically advice you might give to new improv teachers is something we want to talk about later in this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm looking at John now because I am admittedly lost.
Really?
What do we
– Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Okay,
that's one
right.
of the things we wanted to talk about. I'm curious to know how you came to the world of improvisation in the first place.
Oh, that's a good one.
Thanks.
Yes. Kevin, answer that question.
All right. Well, I was in college, and I was studying abroad in London. And there was a guy named Seth from Tufts University, I think, who was also studying abroad. And he was an improv guy. He had, was part of a group called Cheap Socks at Tufts University. And he taught us he did a workshop with us teaching us improv comedy. And it was all short-form games. And I loved it. And we did a few shows at the school in London. And then one night I went over to his room and I said, tell me everything you know about improv. And we spent the next few hours writing down every game, every exercise he knew, because then I thought I would go back to University of Illinois and start an improv group that, you know, my senior year. And at the end of the conversation, he told me about Second City and he told me about Dell, who he thought still worked at Second City. And he told me about Harold, and, you know, I didn't believe it, you know, a half an hour on a single suggestion. It just sounded incredible. So I went back to college. I didn't start a group. It proved to be too daunting. So, but I did move to Chicago with the idea of being an actor. And if you're an actor in Chicago, you got to take improv classes. It's kind of required to at least try it. And so I took classes at a place called Players Workshop, which kind of advertised themselves as the school to take classes to then get into Second City, mm-hmm. which was kind of misleading, but. And a lot of people actually got like, I think Ian Roberts, his first classes in Chicago were also at Players Workshop.
Right. I think I heard about that. And he disliked them, maybe?
It was okay. You know, yeah. I don't know. I stuck with it for the whole year, more for social reasons than anything else. Like, I really liked the people I was taking classes with.
But it wasn't necessarily the thing that they promised that it would be.
Well, I don't want to see it.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't remember what they exactly promised. It seemed like, I mean, they're the Players Workshop of Second City, but they were a separate organization. And you did, I mean, if you did take their year of classes, you would get into the conservatory without having to take some of the early classes. So you would, there was an advantage to it.
Yeah.
But they taught improv in a similar way to Second City, which was as a tool to write sketch material. And they weren't really interested in doing it just by itself. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I eventually took some classes with somebody else and then found my way to Improv Olympic and was there for about 6 years. I was on a team called Frank Booth there. And what else? I started the cage match while I was at Improv Olympic and eventually became a teacher there. I was taught there for a couple years before I moved to New York.
All right. And how was that move to New York? How was the transition from sort of becoming a senior person in Chicago, maybe already sort of a senior person in the IO community, and then kind of uprooting and coming here to a more fledgling world? What was that like?
It was very exciting, very cool. I love New York. I had visited New York a couple times when I was younger and didn't get it. Like, you know, I visited and we went to Times Square, or I visited and we went to, you know, the financial district. And it's just like, this sucks. I don't want to live in this city.
Yeah, you went to all the tourist hotspots, but didn't kind of get under the skin of the city, really.
Right. Well, the neighborhoods where people work, but nobody lives.
Yeah.
And when I came to do the workshop with UCB in 98, I walked around Washington Square. I was in... around Union Square. I think the workshop took place somewhere in Chelsea at the time. And I got it then. I was like, oh, I get it. Cause this is where people were, you know, lived and went out to eat and you know, went to see shows and I got it. It was like a very cool city. So, so I was very excited about that.
What did you do in that workshop?
I don't know. I think I probably did Weird Harold's.
That's right. Which actually, I know you're right. Delaney said that. Was Delaney in that workshop?
Probably. Yeah, I think so. And it was just, I can't even remember what exactly we did, like silent heralds and poetry heralds and musical heralds, where it was a herald, but then you laid on this other thing onto it that were, you know, you could only speak in poetic language, or you could only sing or whatever. So
what was the what was, like, can you talk more about, like, sort of the difference of being at IO, which was more evolved, and then coming out here where it was probably more like the Wild West, I would assume?
Well, it was very different because it's was a much smaller community. I thought that on average, the talent that UCB already had was greater than the average talent at IO, if that makes any sense. Like, the best people at IO were, you know, better than the best people at UCB at that point. But there was just this different – people were on a different level because people were already – there were a lot of people who were already working as writers, who were already sort of clued in on the sort of professional work and just the comedy scene in general in New York. So but their understanding of improv was still pretty new too.
Yeah, maybe it's like less diluted or something. Like, there was no evolved long form improv community here, so everybody, you know, the comedy community had probably centered around other things. So when the UCB arrive and have enough notoriety to attract the best and brightest, they're getting everybody at once.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas in Chicago, it was probably spread out over, like, Second City and IO and Annoyance and people who have moved on already and stuff.
Well, I also think, you know, that IO then, and probably still now to a certain extent, it was much easier to get on a team. I got on a team in level 2 at Improv Olympic. You know, I took one class with Sharna and signed up for the next class, got a call, you're on a team. And the second team I was on was this – after a month, I got put on another team, which became this house team that we were together for 4 years. So
that was Frank
before,
Booth?
Yeah. Before we – before I even got to – take a class with Dell, I was already on a team, and so it just meant that there was lots and lots of people on teams, you know, 30, sometimes close to 40 teams, it seemed like. And that would mean that there's a lot of – it's a little bit diluted, you know.
Right, right.
There were obviously some amazing people, and there was a lot of people who were working towards that. Whereas in New York, that group of people who are still working towards it are going to be on indie teams or performing at other places. There's just not room for them at UCB.
Right.
So by its very nature, that the people on Herald teams are really going to be the cream of the crop, so to speak.
Sure. Right, right.
Plus, there's nowhere else to go. There's no Second City stealing all your best people.
Well, there's more of a community here now. I mean, there's Magnet, there's Pit, there's other.
Yeah, there are more theaters.
It's grown a lot more than when you first got out here, certainly in the late
90s. Right, right. Well, I mean, when somebody gets really good at UCB, where do they go? Well, they go to LA.
Yeah, they go to LA, or they go to famous land.
Yeah, which is also LA.
Oh, right, that's right.
And they still, and yet they still keep coming back and performing. When you got really good at IO in Chicago, you got hired by Second City.
Right.
Or you left. Same thing, I guess.
Yeah.
So it was harder to kind of hold on to people, like the very best people, for too long, I think.
So
now the downside to New York was that nobody knew people. You know, it's not too hard to imagine how to do a good improv scene. Mm-hmm. How to do a good opening or how to do a good group game was impossible for beginning improvisers in New York at the time, I thought, because they just didn't have a very good idea of all the incredible things you could do because they hadn't seen it.
Right. There was no examples to watch.
So then what do you do in a case like that? Like, how did you start to introduce people to how to do things like that?
Well, I think that's where kind of templates come into play, where you know that there's a whole bunch of like a class of games or a type of games that people aren't doing on stage, and so you either by coaching or in class you kind of force them to do games like in a certain mode, and then they just have to get experience with it. They just have to get up there, try it. Eventually they'll succeed at it, and then a light will sort of go off in everybody's head and go, oh, I get it. I see how you could do games like this, or I see how you could do an opening like this. Like, I think – well, I'll give you an example. Like, you know, when I came out, nobody was doing any kind of like organic opening. They were all very – I seem to remember them all being very talky and not a lot of movement and sound and performance-y kind of openings. And then I think like when Monkey Dick first did Cage Match,
right,
and we're doing these really physical openings,
right,
people – it sort of was a light in people's heads like, ah, okay, I see how that can work. Or I think – was it Optimus International who also did a lot of organic?
Yeah, they did it. Although the way I remember it, Monkey Dick was my team, so I'm biased. I think we did it. Well, Billy had us do it first. Billy was our coach.
Yes. Yes, I remember it that way too.
He pushed us into it, made us do it, and partly because he was excited about it, partly to cover for our weaker scenes because we were so new. He was like, you're good at this physical commitment, so let's use it. Mm-hmm. And then I think Brian Husky loved it. We played Pound was our third cage match, which was Brian Husky's team. He loved it. And then when Pound transformed into Optimus International a little bit later, he I think, instigated making them do it. And they were fantastic at it. I feel like they like set the bar for a long time.
Right. But they would have never done it,
I hope,
maybe,
so,
if they hadn't seen Monkey Duke.
It is something once you start seeing people do it, you get inspired, you get a feel for how it works. And then I think out in L.A., now this is twice removed, so take this with a big grain of salt. But I think when L.A. theaters first opened, and maybe a little bit now, not so much now, they had trouble introducing openings beyond monologues or interviews or pattern games, since those are the most accessible. Like, to get a new team to do something kind of arty and weird was harder.
Right.
And I think the Smokes, which is a team of vets and some New York expats, part of the reason they got together was to demonstrate other things.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they would do them all super awesome, but that they could at least show you this is the idea of these different templates and things.
Which, yeah, goes back to what you were saying, Kevin, about showing people what else can be done, what else is out there.
Right, right.
Certainly when Optimus was doing it, everybody wanted to do it, and that always continued. A Herald team would take an opening, make it great, and what formerly had been seen as something to be avoided is embraced because it works. Mm-hmm. You see it working.
You coached a lot of Herald teams while you were here, right, Kevin?
Right.
So what do you try to get out of a Herald team when you start to coach them? Like, what's that process from first getting together and trying to get them all on the same page and trying to make a great Herald team?
Well, I think it depends a lot on the team. I mean, if you're dealing with a team that's been together for a while.
Let's give you some hypotheticals.
Let's say it's a new
team of all students, and this is their first team. And they're good, but it's their first time. There's their first Herald team.
Yeah, I think that's one of the funnest situations to be a coach, because really at that point you're trying to get them all eager to play with one another and get them taking chances, get them to try things rather than to play things safe. So you're doing – I think you want to do a lot of sort of group mind-building exercises. I remember doing that with – I feel like with my kick-ass van. Like I worked with them in the first in the early part, and I remember just making them do lots and lots of group things to make them feel like a unit.
So what are you thinking of when you think of that, right? Let's say you had to do it tonight and you have no time to prepare. What exercises are your first instinct you might grab?
Well, I would think about something like organic openings. I would also think about having them do – just sort of throw ideas at them, like tell them, you know, create an amusement park ride together. Now, go. create a performance art space and describe it and be it. Go. And – whatever I can think of to make them create things together is what I would concentrate on early on. I mean, you know, they're going to be used to doing scene work, and that'll come, I think. What's the awkward part is often going to be the group work early on. So,
yeah.
And I think that's the thing that's really key. The thing that keeps me coming back to Herald is what's different about Herald than any other long form. You know, there's some really important differences. I mean, most long forms don't have group games. Most long forms don't have anything goes type of openings. Most long forms don't require you to do a scene and then you have to bring it back in some form. So those things that make Harold different are often the things that you want to really work on in the early stages, I think.
Let me give you another hypothetical.
Yeah.
Okay.
Say you've come in to coach a Harold team that's been together for a little while, but they're just tanking. You know, they're just not doing very well. They're experienced players, or they've been on a couple of teams, and they're just not doing quality Harolds. What do you do in a situation like that?
Can I specify your hypothetical more, John?
Sure.
And you tell me if this takes away what you want to ask.
Okay.
Let's say it's everybody's second team.
Okay.
So they've been around, and this is their the chemistry isn't working, and they all came. The teams they came from were some better, some worse. But that's it's just, and now they, and they've been together for 6 months, so they're sort of discouraged a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Sure,
right.
And now you are brought in to coach. Go.
Yeah, this would be my. This would not be my funnest situation to coach, because this is probably the hardest situation, especially if you've got people who, you know, felt like their first team was better, you know. Or that, you know, they got kicked off one team and put on this other team.
Well, let's say they're good people and they have good attitudes. Like, let's say that they,
well, that's the most important part. Yeah. If you come into that situation and you're disappointed by being on this new team, there's really hardly anything a coach can do to fix that. If you have people on the team who don't naturally like each other. Or who are expecting that instant chemistry that they had with their first team. You know, a lot of people on their first team that they're on for a while, it becomes this real, like, lovey-dovey bonding kind of experience, you know. Yeah. And so, you know, do people want to do that again, go through that process again? I don't know. I think I might do the opposite. I might just focus in on scene work. And show them, because scene work, you don't have to have such a team bond working. I mean, I think you can sort of walk into most situations and with random set of people and with a little bit of instruction, get them doing good scenes together.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, you know, maybe that would be the way, like attack it from success, you know, get them doing successful scenes. And maybe tell them, let's not worry about the opening. Let's not worry about group games. Just do the simplest thing possible, and let's get your scenes going first.
Let's have some positive experiences together.
Yeah, yeah, I think so. Like, get used to how fun it is to do scenes with these other people, and then and just sort of agree not to worry about openings and so forth. Because I think that would be probably a discussion at that point where everybody comes in and be like, I want to do this opening. I want to do this opening. I don't want to do an opening at all. And so you just say, let's just table that. It's, you know, let's table that. Let's table the discussion about what your name's going to be and just do scenes.
Yeah. What are some pitfalls you're worried about at that point? I guess you've kind of implied what they are, but like, what are things to maybe, I guess as a coach of a team, like, I'm curious what you think of things that you might be tempted to do that are sort of mistakes or not as productive or not as fruitful.
Is it a question of, like, Will, are you wondering, like, are there things that Kevin has experienced?
Yeah, what are you trying to lead me into?
This feels starting to feel very leading.
Well, I think attitude makes such a huge difference. If you walk into a situation and your attitude is, I'm so happy to be here, let's have some fun, or I'm so happy to be here, I want to get better at this, and here's an opportunity to do that, then it's going to be a great experience. If people are bringing their baggage, it's just like relationships. You know, if you're bringing your baggage into the relationship and be like, oh, I hope you're not like the last one, or boy, I really missed the last team I was on, and now I got to deal with you. Then it's not going to be a good situation. And I, you know, I've been all over the place with that with teams. I've mostly been in the situation where it's either it's a really good team that's happy to have me, or it's a new, you know, or that it's a you know, it's an established team that's been playing for a while, and I get to jump in on you know, I know them and I get to jump in as a replacement,
right.
and I'm jazzed about it.
Yeah.
So I've mostly had good experiences, but yeah. I can, you know, those bad experiences, and it's hard. They feed on it themselves. If people go into it thinking, you know, this team isn't going to work, or I don't like these people, or I wish I was on another team, you know, well,
yeah.
it's gonna have a self-fulfilling prophecy. So
right,
sure, and it's gonna wear away at the group mind. Or make it impossible to ever form a group mind.
My question was unfocused. But what intrigues me is, like, veteran teams – I guess I ask because I've done enough coaching now that I've gone all over the place, and I've had a lot of experiences where I look back and I was like, I helped that situation. In other situations, I'm like, it was unhelpable, and I wasn't able to help it. And sometimes I'm like, oh, what I did was sort of the – I've just gone through phases. You know, I go through sometimes where I'm like – it's all about feeling good and the scenes will follow. And I've gone through other phases where, like, sometimes teams need to be, like, challenged, and that rises – they rise to it.
Right.
Where you're, like, treat them like veterans who can do anything, and they will become veterans who can do anything. I'm giving you frustratingly vague examples, I know.
I think those are pretty good examples.
I think challenges are really – I mean, that's a good way to look at it, too, is, like, give them mountains to climb, you know, give them difficult challenges that are doable. And see what they come up with. I guess, you know, forcing them into situations where they have to come up with new solutions to whatever problem you're giving them, and that'll keep them interested.
Yeah.
And I don't think when you're coaching a team, sometimes people make the mistake of if I'm coaching a team, I'm there to teach them, and I don't think that's really true. Maybe to a small extent with new teams, but I think you're there to, you know, facilitate the rehearsals, to get them up on their feet doing stuff, to get them trying things that they may not normally try. And, you know, and also experimenting, you know, coaching is kind of a low impact form of teaching where
right.
you go in and you can try an exercise for the first time. You can try an exercise that occurred to you on the subway ride there.
Yes.
And just flail around with it and see what happens. Whereas if you're walking, you don't want to do that usually when you're walking into a class. When you're walking into a class, you want an exercise that you've smoothed off the. Yeah, and you know how to introduce it. You know what notes you want to look out for, and you know what point you're trying to make by giving them the exercise.
I think that's a good way of putting it, because I know when I first started coaching, I think that I confused coaching and teaching. I thought that it was my responsibility to teach this group something that I knew that they didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
But as I have done it more, I've started to realize that there is less of a responsibility for me to impart this wisdom to them than there is to just find what they are not doing as well and help them get better at it, or to, you know, give them a positive group experience and just get them working.
Well, I think in general, we as improvisers want to learn new things too often. If that makes any sense. Like, there's too many things out there to learn, and what we should probably be doing is learning fewer things and practicing them more.
Yeah. That's a tough balance. I agree with your sentiment. But it's easy to chase the new shiny thing.
Right.
Before just doing reps. I think it's actually harder for the teacher than the students. You always want to be talking about this new thing that you know about.
Yes.
Thing where they're not up to yet, just because you're excited by it, but they are only in their first year of learning improv or something.
It's also like I remember, you know, I took a few years off of improv, and when I first came back to watching it and doing it, I thought that the art and the science of improv would have advanced so far in 3 years that I would not be able to get back on board.
Mm-hmm.
But the first show that I saw was bad. For the same reasons that improv is always bad. And the first good show that I saw was great for all the reasons that improv has always been great.
Yeah.
So the thing is, whenever a show is good or bad, it's always because of the basics. You know, like if people are making missteps in improv, yeah. it's always because they are just forgetting to do the basics of things. And so that's the thing that we want to, if there's, what I take from what you just said, Kevin, is like the things that we should be learning and practicing more are those basics of improv.
Yeah, and I think it might actually be kind of an unintended, really positive thing about the UCB is, you know, the focus on game. You know, a lot of people have some mixed feelings about that, I think, sometimes. I know I did.
Yeah.
Because I think there's a lot more to improv than just the game. But that focus in the curriculum and in the Herald Night and, you know, the ideas coming down from the UCB on game, one thing that does is it actually means that people practice that idea a lot and yeah. get very, very good at it.
Right.
Rather than, you know, taking improv classes from seven different places and never really learning anything for sure.
Right.
You know, you kind of cobble things together after a while, but I think it's probably better to learn, you know, to if you can somehow set it up, you know, maybe take your one class a week and then somehow spend the rest of the time not learning new things, but just practicing those things that you did learn.
Yeah. Well, it's a challenge on both sides of the classroom teaching and learning, I think, because it's a challenge to focus as a teacher or even as a coach. You right. set out an exercise, it has a goal or a muscle that's working. They do it, but while they're doing it, they might be doing the primary thing well, but you notice all these other things that are going wrong and you're tempted right. to jump on that.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to remember, no, this was just supposed to focus. I mean, I find myself doing this a lot. It's very hard for me to not – it's hard for me to remember what was the reason we're doing this. What are we working on right here in yeah. my own head? Like,
note, that's, you know, a big thing actually is yeah. – that would be my biggest note to teachers would be shut up.
Yeah.
yeah. Is learn how to keep really focused with your notes and set up exercises with simple expectations. What are we working on this exercise? We're working on this. And try to give notes just on that thing that you said you were going to give notes on. You know, it was a good example. They did it. Great. Next. Yeah. You know, or here's where you didn't do what we set out to do. Do you see how that affected it?
Right.
Great. Next. Because, you know, I don't know. I've had some really wonderful teachers who talked a lot.
Yes.
I think as a student, you know, I'm actually taking an improv class right now.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, one of the ways to refocus yourself is to, if you're a teacher, is to take a class. Like, it comes yeah. right back to you what you want as a student when you're on that side of it.
Yeah, and for me, and maybe it's where I'm at, is, you know, I want – the whole point in me taking a class was I'm in a situation where I'm not able to improvise as much as I'd like to, and I really wanted to jump back into it, and I can only be in Chicago one day a week. Well, how do I go about this? Well, I'll take a class. And that the experience of taking a class is for me is can certainly be frustrating at times if I feel like we're spending a lot of time talking in class. And I would much rather be doing something in class.
Right.
And these are with teachers. The teachers I've had so far have been pretty good at running efficient classes. They don't waste a lot of time talking, but I still feel it. Even in a situation where things are moving well and we're getting a fair amount done in class, I still feel like, wow, I want to do more. Why can't I just get on stage and do 20 scenes?
Right.
in a row, and that's really what I want to do. So I imagine that students probably feel that all the time, you know, that half a class where they do get up and do one scene in 90 minutes.
I'm feeling guilty.
Will is ready to reconsider the entire curriculum of the school right now.
Well, there's another point along that line that I think is really interesting. You know, I took a fair number of acting classes when I was in Chicago. And often those acting classes, you know, we'd be taking the class for 8 weeks. We didn't do 16 different exercises in 8 weeks. There are some classes that met eight times and we did one exercise the whole time.
Yeah.
And I that makes me wonder about certain the way we approach improv classes. I wonder if there are too many exercises, or if the exercises are sometimes too scattered.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm speaking as somebody who helped write the curriculum or the early versions of the curriculum.
I mean, you're sympathetic to the challenges of it because.
Oh yeah.
The other side of it is you want to give students a shared vocabulary so that like. By the time they finish your basic program, they've all been exposed to certain things,
right?
If only to connect them to a community. Like, you want them to know what certain terms mean just so they can be part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. Like,
well, and also if you're teaching something like Harold, there's an awful lot to teach. There's a lot of pieces to it. Whereas, you know, if you said, like, let's say you're going to start from scratch and create a new improv school – you might say to yourself, you know, I'm just going to teach people how to do good two-person improv scenes.
Right.
And that makes everything much simpler because right. you don't need to worry about openings and group games and how you bring back scenes in the third beat. All you worry about is, okay, how do you start a scene? How do you get a scene moving forward? How do you find a game? What do you do once you find that game? It's a much more limited number of questions, and so you can spend – you know, 4 weeks on agreement or right. much, you know, or 8 weeks on just agreement exercises or something like that.
One thing that I wanted to ask you for is at least one story about your experience with Del Close. Something that sticks out to you. I feel like anytime we get somebody that has had contact with Del, I always right. want to hear at least one story, either like, you know, an impression you had of him or some specific memory from a class or a show that you remember.
Right, right. Well, I had a couple classes with him, you know, when I was a student at Improv Olympic. And then I didn't have a lot of interactions with him for a few years because he didn't really come to see shows. He came occasionally to see a Harold show and wouldn't really last very long and would leave. he didn't really like watching them.
Because he didn't think they were being done well enough, or he just couldn't
I think
stand.
He liked the Harolds well enough. And we would also do short-form games throughout the evening. There was an opening game of musical options. In the middle of the show, we would do The Dream,
that still
which was like an interview-based one. And then at the end of the show, we'd do Freeze Tag. And he, I don't think he liked that part of it. I think the Heralds were he would sometimes enjoy. Mm-hmm. But I think he'd probably seen too much improv in his life. Yeah. You know, because we didn't do Heralds in his class, for instance. Or if we did, he would really shake it up. By the time we got to his class was like an experimental lab. And he would come into class and he would tell us what he had been thinking about for the last, you know, day or week or something like that. And then he would say, all right, I want you to try and do this on stage. So it was all about us trying to put on stage whatever was in his head.
Like, and give me an example of that. Like, what okay. were the kinds of this things that he would have you do on stage?
Okay. So... Oh, what was the name of it? There was rituals. One thing he had us do would be to create rituals on stage. He would get us on stage. He would say, I want you to create like the equivalent of a tribal rain dance, or, you know, a tribal ritual ceremony to commemorate, you know, the change of seasons or something. And then he would turn out the lights and we would be on stage dancing around, banging on, you know, making percussion sounds, singing. You know, trying to create an altered state of mind, right? After he had us do that for a while, he decided he wanted us to do something called the Oracle. And he went into this long, probably like half hour description of his idea of what a Greek oracle was. And which was basically that they would have these oracles drugged up. And then the priest would go into the temple and ask the oracle a question. The oracle would give them a sort of nonsensical response. And then the priests and priestesses would go out and interpret whatever the oracle said. Well, the reason the oracles would be saying these crazy things is because they were sort of drugged up and sort of kept in kind of this trance-like state. So he had us go on stage. One person was decided to be the or was chosen to be the oracle. And then we would create a ritual around that person to try and alter their state of mind. We would ask them a question, create the ritual, and at a point when they thought that they were ready, they would essentially start speaking. It was almost like speaking in tongues, except everything was supposed to be some sort of combination of actual English words and gibberish. And then that would be the opening for a improvisation. And then the oracle would come off stage, and the priests or priestesses that were had made the ritual around them would then interpret the words of the oracle, the sort of nonsensical words of the oracle, and do a bunch of scenes. And then if possible, at the end of the form, someone would come forward and try to interpret what the oracle was getting at through the scenes and answer the question that was posed to the group at the beginning. And so that was the kind of weird, freaky idea that Dell would come in with and say, here, do this on stage.
Wow.
Go ahead. Well, he would come up – some of his ideas were a little bit more conventional or a little bit easier to see how they would work on stage. But he often wasn't really that concerned with how something would work on stage, I felt. Or he wasn't concerned if it, you know, took him another 2 years to figure out how this would actually work on stage. You know, and he would also just experiment around a lot. The format that eventually became the Armando Diaz show, and that is also the same format or similar format for ASCAT, really was based on stuff that was coming out of Dell's class, I thought. Because a lot of his forms were just combinations of monologues and scenes and trying different ways to combine those things. Hmm. And the people who came up with the idea for the Armando show, they were influenced by that. And there were other shows that had sort of tried that simple mix of monologues and scenes and, and benefited from all that experimenting from that came out of Dell's class, I think.
What did you think of Dell at that time when you're in that advanced class? How did you feel about him?
I really liked it. I did not have – I think people would have some mixed feelings about it, because often he would talk for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it was very hard to see what the connection between what he was talking about and what he wanted us to eventually do.
Right.
He told us this long story about how this ritual that he had done in the forests in Canada or something about where they had summoned a demon by dancing around this fire. And he takes a long time to explain. And then I think we did some sort of exercise that was, to visualize this. I thought it was I took some really meaningful things away from the talk for my life, but I don't know if it helps me in my improv at all.
Yeah.
You know. But
yeah,
I enjoyed it mostly.
Went into my 101 class and did that, I think people after a while would look at me pretty crazy. Or maybe not.
Well, I mean, basically the quality of Dell's class varied wildly. You know, sometimes his class would seem like, what are we doing?
Yeah.
He definitely had some classes where you just sort of left going, what was that? but then you would have other classes where he would just sort of casually dispense of some wisdom or sort of give you a note that seems so profound or so simple it was worth it. It was worth the times when he was just kind of fumbling around. I think he went through a period after, he was having a pretty good period with us, and then he kind of had a period after us where in the sort of mid-90s where I think he was really, really enjoying it because he was regularly putting up shows. You know, when I was taking his class, those classes did not become shows. But kind of the inspiration for our 600 or for the ECB 600 level classes came from the last few years of Dell, where you know you went through all the levels and then you had a class with Dell, and he would take your class after one or two sessions and put it up as a show at the theater.
Right.
And he got to do a lot of the things he was experimenting with over time and put them up on stage. And I think what was nice about that, my impression of it was that he was finally getting students regularly who could do what he asked them to do.
Yeah.
You know, I think, in other words, he didn't have to, by the time they got to Dell, they had had, you know, so much training that they actually could kind of do what he was asking. Whereas I think in the past, he often had students who, or he sort of saddled with students and they were still struggling with the basics. And so
yeah,
it was maybe more frustrating for him. I'm not sure about that though.
Right. Mm-hmm. John and I wanted to talk to you about a class we had with you that we liked a lot.
Yeah, I was just telling Will before we started about how you are definitely one of the biggest influences as far as teachers that I've had.
Mm-hmm.
You're one of the most influential teachers that I had, and I can recall doing so many great things in classes with you as a teacher. And there was one in particular that I know Will and I have talked to you in the past about, and Will and I are pretty regularly talking about it. It was that it was kind of a Meisner-esque improv class. I don't even remember if it was a 301.
It's 401.
It was a 401?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I just converted it into Meisner for 8 weeks.
I think the whole class. They weren't called 401s yet, I think.
Yeah,
I did that a couple of times, and then I ended up teaching it as a class all by itself.
Yeah,
you know, one of my scariest moments with that was I was teaching this exercise, which was, you know, I'd learned in Chicago in an acting class, and it was based on how Meisner used to teach. I was teaching that exercise one day at UCB, and a guy in the class had studied with Meisner for like 15 years.
Oof,
and
wow.
So I suddenly felt like an idiot. Like, how can what have I got to teach this guy about Meisner? He told me afterwards, not, you know, it was like we'd done it a little bit in class one day. And then he sort of came up to me later. And he's like, oh yeah, I get it. I get the connection between this. And he had been doing it for years and years. I think he taught Meisner technique. So
wow. Anyway.
What a nightmare.
It was a little weird. It was a little humbling.
My memory of that class is a lot of very deep, kind of quiet exercises and scene work, like a lot of getting up on stage with somebody else and repeating things to each other, or just kind of like looking at the other person and reacting to what you thought they were giving you.
Mm-hmm.
Right, Will? Am I?
Yeah, that's right. I don't remember that there was any warning of this either. I feel like it was just level four with Kevin Mullaney. I don't think we had any idea what it was going to be. Although the level fours were all very individual to the teacher, so mm-hmm. that it was something that wasn't a surprise.
Do you want me to explain what we were basically doing?
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, so the idea, we were using an exercise called repetition, which again was, I believe, it was certainly used a lot by Sandy Meisner, teaching actors. And the basic idea of it is you get on stage, one person says something, the other person repeats that thing, and it goes back and forth until you feel like saying something else. And the point of the exercise is to learn to trust your gut impulses to do certain things. Trust your gut impulses toward, you know, as far as reading what you're seeing in the other person, their emotion and their behavior and interpreting it, and also trusting your gut to do the thing, to react in a way that your gut is telling you to react. And so we would do a lot of it. We would do some of those exercises, and I think we led into, depending on which class it was, we led into using it in scene work as like the beginning at the tops of scenes, and my goal was to get improvisers to be better actors, really, and to bring a palette of behavior and emotion into their scene work, so it's not just, you know, clever 20-year-old guys talking to each other about clever things.
Yeah.
You know,
Star Wars. There's
Star Wars would be an example. I want them to feel Star Wars.
That's something that I remember getting out of it for sure. And as a matter of fact, wasn't the class called Improvising from the Gut?
That's right. It did have that title.
Yeah.
Right.
And that's something that I definitely remember getting out of it is feeling like I was a more rounded performer and actor in the class, like really digging deep into those kinds of feelings and stuff.
Right. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking that like, oh, at first it was sort of annoying, although also intriguing to sort of just – because I think the first day was like, okay, go up and be on stage and just that's it. And you'd be up there like wondering, well, am I doing this right? And sometimes right. You would even ask from the stage, what do you want me to do? I'm remembering this only halfway.
Mm-hmm.
But it was this sort of frustration, like doing nothing. But then like after a couple classes of that, I remember becoming more sensitive to all these little decisions and reactions that were happening all the time. Like the moment you step on stage, you are emitting some sort of energy. You are experiencing little decisions and reactions. And if you're sensitive to it, that's all you need to start improvising with somebody. You're on stage with them. You're looking at each other. The scene has begun. So if you can be sensitive to it, the audience is certainly sensitive to it, then that to me was like the missing piece of improv that I had been sort of looking for. Like, why is it that some people up there look natural and reactive and good and other people look like they're just saying shit? Like, what's the difference from the inside?
Yeah, and I think there's a lot of good improvisers who do it, and maybe it's not necessarily that they have some grand acting background. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. I mean, I'm thinking of a lot of the really great like two-person and three-person shows that have happened over the years, something like TJ and Dave or Weird Ass.
Weird Ass, right.
Where
John Frusciante.
That's right.
We have never done that.
the Hines Brothers.
Yeah, right.
where these are really you lose yourself in the scenes in similar ways that you lose yourself in a play, and you're just watching people behave. And some really interesting things might happen in a scene that are beyond just two people talking to each other in a clever way. You know, there's definite interesting things happening on a emotional and behavioral level that if the actors notice it and use it, it becomes something, I don't know, more profound.
Yeah. Right. You know? Some people do have it naturally and other people do get it via training or something, or some people have it in certain combinations with other people naturally.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a hard thing to teach or to even become aware of, and makes a big difference to people who are trying to improvise a lot and improvise really powerfully. I remember after that class feeling a lot more open and freer. You too,
yeah.
John.
Oh, right? Yeah, like absolutely.
It got simpler in a nice way.
Yeah, it's definitely like weird at first to be sitting next to somebody or sitting across from somebody and just be looking at them. And just being like just judging what you think that they're giving off, especially in contrast to all the other improv classes that I had taken.
And I don't mean to imply either that by the end of 8 weeks we had like mastered that at all.
I totally mastered it.
Yeah, John.
Yeah,
totally.
That's how I remember it too. I remember John mastering.
John 100% got it.
Mm-hmm.
I remember
kind of
that guy who had Meisner. I remember came in and said, "This kid gets it." but it, like,
no,
it
one thing
it exposed and made me aware of a certain like thing going on stage that occupies me a lot still.
Sure.
I still think about that a lot.
One of my favorite exercises that I started doing probably about midway through my time in New York was an exercise where I'd have three people on stage and have them do a silent scene, which in years past when I had have people do silent scenes, they didn't often work very well, I didn't think. Sometimes they did, sometimes they didn't. And with these, I would have three people on stage and put them in a situation where you wouldn't really be talking, like in a waiting room, like a doctor's waiting room or a lot of waiting rooms, to be honest. A lot of waiting room scenes. But you put three people
like
on stage.
On a subway platform with strangers.
Sure.
Or in an elevator, like you don't – talking is at a urinal. Is that weird to say?
In a public bathroom. That would actually be an excellent location for this. And you put people in there and you say, you can't talk, but I want you to react to each other, to notice each other. And if, you know, and once people start to get attuned to it, it's amazing. You know, someone can shift from one chair to another and it's hilarious.
Yeah.
Because you see why they shifted, you know, you can see the reaction they're having to somebody else and why they want to move away from them. Or how, you know, two people are sort of looking at each other and smiling, you know, laughing about the third person. And there's no dialogue or anything. It's all just behavior, and it can sometimes be really, really interesting.
So the difference is creating a real-life template where you would be communicating non-verbally. I mean, like, where you wouldn't be talking. So, like, you can draw from reality rather than having to artificially decide not to talk.
Right.
That was sort of like the tweak that helped that exercise.
Yeah, because I had seen this done at the cage match finals in Chicago one year. There was a group from, I don't know, from New Zealand or something. Is it New Zealand or Australia? I can't remember. But and I think it was the year – it might have been the year the Swarm was out there to do it. Anyway, these guys, for their they made it to the finals of the cage match competition there, and – for their final 20 minutes, they did one silent scene, and I think it was three guys. So they did a 25-minute silent scene, and it was hilarious. It was riveting. And what they did was they set it in a movie theater before a movie started. So the three of them are sitting in a movie theater for 20 minutes, and, you know, by the end of it, people are, you know, somebody is – been murdered and came back as a zombie, and I mean, it got pretty absurd. It wasn't this, you know, this study in natural human behavior long period of time.
It was, but I can see that would blow the audience away, though.
Yeah, I think they won, and they won because it was like, you know, they were from Australia. They had no friends in the audience.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just and on I the think basis of the work. Chicago team in the finals. You know, so that home team advantage is not necessarily true in cage match.
No, the best show wins in cage match. That's what I think.
Always.
Yeah, I used to be of the opposite opinion, but I have converted. Will has converted me.
I have.
Through conversation and evidence.
I've been at shows, been like, the other team has the house stacked, right? The best show will win anyway. Ben Rogers told me that, because Ben Rogers hosts a lot of them now, with Charlie and Eric. And, I mean, if it's really close, those factors that get cited make a difference. Mm-hmm. If it's like two great shows, then like the better known team might win, the team with more teachers, the team that goes second. Those factors have like a 10 vote effect.
Sure.
Or something. Mm-hmm. But if a show's better, that is the hugest weapon you can have to win cage match. Way more than anything.
Yep.
Well, I think we got to wrap it up here. I think we're
Yeah, I think so. I think the biggest question is, when are you coming back to New York?
Yeah.
When are you going to come back here and clean house?
Just waving a baseball bat around.
I don't know. I don't know yet. I definitely will be back, and you know, I'll spend some time there when I do come back. So I'm working. You know, I'm working on creating some new sort of templates for workshops that I want to do.
Yeah, like, so. You might be. Am I wrong to think that you were even thinking of traveling to a couple of places and trying them out and stuff?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I went to – I tried some stuff out this past weekend in Chicago with a group of students. And I've got some people over at Bradley University here in Peoria that I'm working with.
Right.
I've worked with a few times. And, again, I'm just trying stuff out with them.
Yeah.
With the hope of creating a, you know – a scalable workshop that I can take to festivals and take to the Del Close Marathon, that kind of thing, where I come in and teach for a few days and then move on to the next place.
Great. Well, do it.
You're like some kind of improv Incredible Hulk.
Yes.
Just sweep into a town.
Yeah. Just come wandering in, this mysterious stranger, get angry.
Just don't make me angry.
Change that's the right. course of events and then just wander
and then
out.
Walk back out the way you came.
Music and that's it.
Thanks so much, Kevin.
Yes.
Did you have something else, Will?
It was a stupid joke.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I don't want to make it now.
All right.
Kevin wants to plug something.
Oh, go ahead.
I want to plug my podcast.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yes.
In part inspired by your own podcast.
Oh, wow.
Well, I just thought it was so along with a lot of other things, it's so easy to sort of keep connected with people from other cities. Anyway, so I my own podcast, the Improv Resource Center podcast, where I interview teachers and directors of improv from all over the place.
And where can people find that?
At theimprovresourcecenter.com.
Right. We will mention that in the description for this, so it'll be at the beginning, not buried at the end.
That's right.
We forgot to mention it at the beginning. Yeah, but thanks so much for doing this, Kevin. We were very excited, and we'd like to do it again sometime.
Yeah, it's so great to talk to you.
I'd love to do it anytime.
And what else do we have, John? Is that it for this week?
I think that's it.
All right, so thank you, everybody, for listening. Have another episode next week, so stay tuned for that.
Yeah, we're back on track now after a little bit of...
Right, we lost our way with other commitments, but now we realize that this is more important than anything else.
That's right, we went to kind of a workshop over the weekend that restored our spirituality. We meditated.
We did a ritual, and we're back. So, come back next week for another episode. Thank you, Kevin, and
that's
bye-bye.
Goodbye.